Banfield.
Happy Friday Eve. Good to have you here. Thanks for being here. I'm the Banfield on the Banfield Show. And there are some guys who may be watching television tonight who would prefer to be maybe out for dinner with their lawyers. And instead, they're stuck in prison. This was supposed to be such a big night, such a big day for the Menendez brothers, right? This was the beginning of the resentencing process. We thought we might actually get a decision going into this thing. It's been 3.5 decades since they've been locked away. And today, they were told they kind of had to wait a little longer. I know, you've heard this before. Very frustrating. But what's interesting about how today played out is that these two brothers sat quietly and patiently by Zoom in the courtroom, right? They're at their prison, zoomed into the courtroom, while the lawyers were at each other's throats. I mean, it was epic. Their lawyer and the state's lawyer going at it and taking to the mics, too. I've got a big explanation of what happened today, and then what's even more fascinating is we've got an interview with a guy who spent time, who served with Eric and Lyle, years with Eric and Lyle, and credits Eric and Lyle with the reason that he turned his life around and that he's able to do this interview with us tonight. I can't wait for this because there's a lot that he says that you don't learn if you just met them on Netflix. Okay, then the other thing is, does Luigi Mangione deserve to die? He is fighting mad at the feds, saying they're all over the place yammering on about Luigi taking away his jury pool and making them biased. But I have a question for you, especially if you're a Luigi fan. Is the jury pool already biased for him? Remember this thing? Remember this perp walk from the... Look at this. It's like, look at the SWAT all around him. This was crazy. Can the government actually fight the jury poisoning that already exists? The legions of lovers, the legions of fans, the people who write music tributes to him. I'm going to lay all of this out for you, and I've got some news on what happened to Luigi tonight. And then, do you remember the school principal I told you about a couple months ago? I actually had to look back in the calendar. I thought it could be months, could be years. It was a couple months ago. Big, huge party, 100-plus kids out at her house, drank in and having fun. She's the one on the right and the one on the left. The school principal in better days on the right, and then after the arrest in the middle there. So it turns out we didn't see everything that night. We saw a lot. We saw a lot. She was arrested for having like 100 kids with liquor and all the rest at her house. But we didn't see her sidecar, her friend, her ride or die. Because the principal had a friend who was a third grade teacher, and there's her image. But the booking image is nothing compared to the video. I'm telling you, they do not make third grade teachers like this anymore. Roll it, Jamie.
I was here hanging out at this party. I mean, what the f***? What's wrong with them?
Okay.
You guys gotta act better.
Do you want the truth? There was like 200 kids here drinking.
I've already known.
Drinking, okay? And you're drunk as well.
I'm not drunk.
Yes, you are. I smell it.
Oh, you smell it. You
yes.
Wanna... All right, let's do it.
No, we're not
test.
Getting...
And there were a lot more F-bombs where that came from. Imagine if we had talked back to our third grade teacher using that language. That was a cop. Okay, I'm going to play the whole video for you because that is just a soupçon, and it is something to behold. I want to start here, though. It must have come as amazing news to Eric and Lyle Menendez back in February when California's governor dipped his toes into their case. Gavin Newsom ordered something called a comprehensive risk assessment, and that is basically the state parole board's best guess as to the danger that these brothers might pose if they ever leave prison. And this was a big step, right? Because Lyle and Eric have done pretty much everything that a parole board wants prisoners to do. And then some, actually. And if their risk assessment report is the only thing standing between them and freedom, well, you can imagine them packing up their cells tonight. But ironically, that risk report, contents of which still unknown to you and me, by the way, is the one thing that may keep them locked up a little longer, a couple of months longer anyway. And let me tell you why. Today was supposed to be resentencing day, right? This was supposed to be the day when the judge heard both the pros and the cons of letting them out and then, you know, making a decision. But the judge said, wait, I may not be able to do that, because the DA said the judge has to look at that report before making any decision. And so here we are again tonight with yet another delay in the battle to get him out of jail. And you can tell it is taking its toll. Maybe not so much on Eric and Lyle, because they're used to being locked up. Those two sat quietly on Zoom throughout the whole process today. But their lawyers, man, the lawyers are fighting mad. After the DA threw his spike in the process with the whole risk assessment thing, judge, you got to see that before you can. Lyle and Eric's lawyer moved to recuse that DA, especially since the DA showed bloody crime scene photos in the last hearing without warning the family that they were coming, and one of those family members ended up in the hospital. Here is what Mark Garagos, the brother's attorney, told Brian Enten tonight on Cuomo.
The victims, who also happen to be my client's family, both they're both their family and they're the victims. They have been savaged and traumatized repeatedly by this new DA, and starting with last Friday when grisly crime scene photos are put up there, and they were given no warning whatsoever. Today, they filed, or last night, the DA filed a motion to continue the case without notifying any of the victims, once again, violating Marcy's Law, which is a constitutional provision for victims. And so we decided today, after the latest shenanigans, that they want a continuance. That's fine. We're going to continue it just long enough to move to recuse, basically to ask the judge to throw the DA off the case and find somebody who is at least partially in compliance with the Constitution.
So tonight, Lyle and Eric eat another meal in the chow hall of the Richard J. Donovan Correctional Facility, where the brothers have been for years. And at the same time, someone who spent years with them in that prison is here with me. Anna Ray, X-rated Brown, was sentenced to life for a gang-related murder, but he credits Lyle and Eric with helping him turn his life around, earn his parole, and find success as a rapper. X-rated, thanks for being on tonight. I really appreciate this chance to talk with you. You know them better than most people out there who've just seen the documentary, you know, on Netflix. How do you suppose they're taking the news of what happened today and all these delays one after the other?
They are very composed people. And in that environment, an unfortunate consequence of what they've been through the judicial system, the courts of appeals, putting in habeas petitions and things like that. There's a lot of rejection. There's a lot of waiting, hoping, and then an eventual settling in into the reality of what your experience is. So they've seen a lot. They've been through a lot of these processes, and I believe that they're handling everything with composure. I did a video chat with both of the brothers and the family earlier this evening, and They were okay. They were okay.
What'd they say? Tell me about the chat. I don't know if you're allowed to.
Well, it just seemed, it was like, you know, more waiting than here we go, you know, but it was more focused on them having the opportunity to speak with the family. You know, there were probably about 14 of us gathered in that room, maybe a little less than that. But to see Terry through the video chat. So I think we were more focused on that side of it, family, and just a little bit of joy within the waiting and more waiting. So, yeah, the focus in this particular instance was just on family and the joy of seeing family. Yeah.
So Terry, if I'm not mistaken, is Jose's sister. She's the person who went to the hospital. She's in her 90s after those pictures came up in the hearing last week of Jose's body riddled with bullets. It was a very upsetting crime scene picture, and the family's upset. They didn't get warned about that. You said that she was on the video chat tonight. How is she?
The boys were able to see her. You know, she's an amazing woman, one of the strongest women that you'd ever encounter, a fantastic spirit, and she's gaining strength, and we're proud for that. We're happy about that.
Is she out of the hospital?
I wouldn't want to speak on behalf of the family with regard to things that are too specific in details like that. I don't believe it's appropriate for me to do that.
Understand completely. And I actually want to steer the conversation towards your time that you spent with Eric and Lyle, because for a lot of us, we see it on paper. We're reading the reports. We're reading that they've done all these programs. They had started all these, you know, these programs to help other inmates, to make a jail and a prison facility more of an environment for rehabilitation, right? And we rarely get the chance to speak with people who spent the time. So walk me through a little bit about what these two men are like from your perspective.
So interestingly enough, you know, they always talk about, oh, Lyle, he's portrayed as this arrogant guy. And when we first met, I was a 24, 25-year-old rapper with music out. I'm hitting the Billboard charts. I'm in Playboy magazine, LA Times, and, you know, I was the one that was a bit cocky. And we were at an institution together, and I'm wearing big chains and, you know, Rolexes and diamonds in my ears, even though you're not supposed to have that type of stuff. And I did an interview in the day room with the music magazine, and, you know, they had cameras and lights set up. And, you know, of course, Lyle observed that, and a day later or so, he called me over to him and we had a conversation where, you know, he just told me he thought I had so much more potential than, you know, some of the characteristics that I was exhibiting. I still was associating with non-gang members. It still mattered to me what people thought of me, my perception, you know, being flashy, refusing to do jobs on the prison facility grounds. And, there was Lyle who told me that he thought I could use my influence for positive means. And I respected the fact that, you know, his stature, he had a lot of media coverage. As in that population, there aren't a lot of us who have what you would call celebrity. You know, you have people who are doing their time and just trying to get through their experience. That's the great majority of the population. And then you'll have somebody like myself and Alau Menendez, and I could look at him as someone who was doing well and, you know, doing interviews with Barbara Walters. So I just thought that his input was important for me to accept. I was at a stage in my life where I'd been thinking these things, but I didn't necessarily have the fortitude at the time to start applying what I believed was necessary for my life. And Lyle was the one who pushed me towards starting to educate myself and go to self-help groups and things like that. And so, you know, I started doing so, anger management courses, meetings with psychologists, AANA. And then I transferred to a facility where Eric was. And Lyle wrote him a letter and told him I was on my way. And he said, treat him like I arrived. You know, I love him. You love him. And so Eric's like, all right, I got you. And Eric kind of took it from there. I did NA groups with him, AA groups, 12-step groups, meditation groups, participated in a life care and hospice program that he actually founded. And yeah, they just encouraged me to do everything that I could to improve myself. Once Senate Bill 260 came into law in 2012, authored by Senator Lonnie Hancock, and signed into law by Governor Jerry Brown in 2013. The brothers were just so excited for the fact that I qualified as a youthful offender and had an opportunity to, as someone who faced the death penalty as a 17-year-old, ultimately was transferred over to adult court, defeated the death penalty aspect, and then ultimately was convicted and sentenced to 31 years to life in state prison. I became eligible for parole as a youthful offender in 2013 when that
Amazing.
When that when Senate Bill 260 was signed into law.
And this is what's so incredible is that this is the law that they are now qualifying under for a resentencing is the youthful offender law. So they helped you to basically petition, get out of prison on parole and change your life. And now look at you. I mean, a success story. One of the things I never hear about X-rated or rarely hear about is cohesion between the races in prison. And I did not know that you and the brothers actually got together and worked towards sort of mediation between between different races in prison. It's just sort of a story you don't hear very often. Tell me a little bit about that and how you ended up being like the little brother almost of these guys.
Yeah, I believe that what we experienced was hopelessness in that environment. There was pervasive hopelessness and learned helplessness in that environment. And, you know, hurt people hurt people. So we had a proliferation. The population just exploded as a result of the three strikes law where, you know, people who weren't necessarily hardened criminals, but maybe, you know, people who had drug problems, they got three strikes for, you know, they had a fight, a fist fight before, they stole a slice of pizza, now they have 25 to life. Population explodes. We have this crisis of overcrowding, and there was just pervasive hopelessness. And then when the laws started to change, the California's fight to repeal the three strikes law, and then Senate Bill 260 going into effect and lifers actually having a legitimate opportunity to go home, which partially is a travesty of justice because 260 was authored largely as a result of the SCOTUS ruling in Miller versus Alabama, which was a debate about capital punishment for juveniles focused on the death penalty and LWOP, which would actually have applied to Lyle and Eric, but instead of addressing LWOPs, California chose to focus on people with indeterminate sentences, right, such as myself. Right. So this law actually came into effect as a result of them examining things that would have applied to Lyle and Eric, but they chose to go in a different direction in order to, I think California wanted to have a lighter rollout and not have.
Yeah, I'm so sorry to cut you off. I have to leave it there, but I want to have you back on the program because clearly today ended without, you know, the result that we wanted, which was some resolution. And when there is resolution, I'd love to have you back because clearly this is near and dear and personal to you. So I hope you'll come back on the program again.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to it.
Me too. NRA X-rated Brown. Do appreciate that. Coming up after the break, will we be talking about Luigi Mangione like this in 30 years as well? Or will Luigi Mangione long be dead? Because if the government gets its way, he will be a distant memory. And that's why tomorrow Luigi is head to head with Uncle Sam, saying the government and their smack talk is tainting the jury against him and that the death penalty should therefore be off the table. But even if you tried your hardest, is it possible to change the minds of all of those lovesick fans who are oozing out of the internet?
A white guy in a jumper who looked just like the gunner offered me his number on my ride to the station.
May not be the smash hit of the summer, but it is one of many musical tributes to an accused assassin. Can the feds and the state of New York and the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania beat this? Life and death and the super fans in the middle when we come back. Walks in my life than I've seen movies, but never did I ever see one like this. Luigi Mangione being paraded like he's Scarface. I call this the chopper walk. He's flown into New York from Pennsylvania, the state where he was arrested, and then was met on the Hudson River, but what looked like the 10th Mountain Division and every SWAT team in the country. I mean, look at this. And all these different divisions of people there. I mean, all this for a kid in his 20s accused of a single murder? I mean, murder's bad, okay, but this ain't Hannibal Lecter. For God's sake, New York's mayor and police commissioner were following just a few steps behind all those automatic weapons, you know, to make sure Luigi wouldn't get away. This perp walk happened 15 days after Brian Thompson was assassinated on a New York sidewalk. He was the CEO of United Healthcare. And after an epic manhunt, the feds caught Luigi and say that the evidence sure points to him being that assassin. His lawyer called this thing a political stunt, a staged circus designed to convict Mangione in public long before he ever faced a jury. They became even more convinced of that after the U.S. Attorney General announced on Instagram that the feds would seek the death penalty for charges that were not even official. And guess what? They haven't been official until tonight. That's the breaking news. A federal grand jury has just tonight handed up a four-count indictment against Luigi, and that includes two counts of stalking, one count of murder using a firearm, and a weapons offense related to the use of that silencer that was used to kill the CEO. A hearing is set for tomorrow, and we're going to be watching as closely as we can, but you know, no cameras are allowed because federal. But when it comes to shifting the zeitgeist for or against a murder suspect, this may not be a David and Goliath kind of fight. Or if it is, Luigi, not the government, might just be the Goliath here. How many alleged assassins do you know with musical tributes on YouTube and TikTok?
Yourself a martyr, see your life is over now, and ours will keep on getting harder just the same.
Okay, this is just a couple. If you search love songs to Luigi, you will be busy all night. Just wait for the show to end, if I may ask. I'm joined now by Dave Ehrenberg, defense attorney in Florida and former top prosecutor in Palm Beach County. Dave Ehrenberg, is it possible to poison a jury pool if you're the attorney general? Or is the jury pool already poisoned by love potion number 9?
You can look at it both ways, Ashley, with all the love songs to him. So, yeah, the AG is pushing back. And I think part of the reason why they're seeking the death penalty is because this administration hates the people who are there advocating for Luigi. Not many of them are Trump voters. And I think that they're looking at this as, hey, this is a way to own the libs. But also, let's send a message to the whole country that this kind of cowardly murder, he lay in wait, wore a mask, ran away, is not going to be tolerated.
It is pretty cowardly if he's the killer. I just wondered about the battle. Usually it's defense attorneys that want to get the message out there and poison a jury pool. And the feds seem to be shackled, pardon the pun, a little more. Is that the case here, or are we seeing kind of like Pam Bondi saying gloves are off, we're going to play you at your own game?
Yeah. This is a PR offensive, and prosecutors generally don't do it, but there's nothing normal about this case. The whole country's talking about it. I don't think a jury pool can be tainted when it's already been tainted, and you can always find a jury because not everyone pays attention to the news. I mean, in every high-profile case, you can find a jury. I think, though, it's going to be impossible to get the death penalty, Ashley, because they're going to have to find New York jurors. Even though it's federal court, it's New York jurors who are really reluctant to give the death penalty, a unanimous verdict for death for this good-looking young superstar from the left? No, I don't think it's going to happen. And by the way, you can see the way I'm talking that I think he's totally guilty. I just don't think they're going to get capital punishment here.
So I would have said this prior to last November, but New York also swung very heavily, more so than ever before, for Republicans and for Trump in particular. So you don't think that a New York jury can still have the get tough on crime attitude as they go in and deliberate this guy's fate?
Sure, but not all 12. It has to be unanimous to give him the death penalty, and I think that's impossible in New York. Plus, really, he's this young, good-looking guy who has no prior record. They're not going to give him the death penalty. It's just the reality of things.
Just give me a quick comment on this perp walk, because every time I see it, I get a new, like, movie title in my head.
Yeah, Eric Adams, as the mayor of New York, should have been nowhere near this. And that's why the defense lawyer, Karen Agnifilo, is right that this was politicized. When a politician is there next to police walking with this guy in front of the cameras, you know it's been politicized. So, yeah, there's nothing that could take politics out of this situation.
It was just missing Sly Stallone, you know, walking on point for this group. I just couldn't get over this. I thought it was a joke. I thought I was being punked. Dave Ehrenberg, always love having you. Thank you for this.
Thank you, Ashley.
All right, guys, coming up, more than 100 teenagers in a house full of booze. What could go wrong? Well, one thing you might not imagine is that one of the adults present would pick a fight with the cops outside. And the ensuing body cam is nothing short of delicious.
I'm concerned about a child that's being put into a machine, into one of these vehicles, and it's none of my business.
There was like 200 kids here drinking.
I've already known.
Drinking, okay? And you're drunk as well.
I'm not drunk.
Yes, you are. I smell it.
Oh, you smell it.
I used to say that to my mom. Do you remember we brought you this story a couple months back? Well, now it's a hell of a lot better because now we've got more body cam video, and I am promising you, you must stay for this because I'm going to show you how this played out next. Let more than 100 teenagers use your house for the mother of all keggers. Because that allegedly happened in Brevard County, Florida, back in January. And we told you about it at the time. Do you remember? An elementary school principal named Elizabeth Hill Brodigan, who is now a former principal. She was arrested, as was the only other adult on site, when the police showed up. And how did the police find out? How did they know? We now know that there were many calls to 911.
Hi, I just wanted to let you know that I'm in this group chat with a bunch of kids at this party, and they're all sending videos of, like, everybody drinking, and there's, like, fights going on.
When the officers arrived, they found a teenager throwing up in the front yard, so Natch, they called for EMS, at which time Principal Hill Brodigan allegedly turned off the outside lights, forcing the paramedics to treat the kid by the lights on their rig. And that's where the other adult I mentioned now comes in. Her name is Carly Anderson, and she was a third grade teacher at the principal's school. Here she is being schooled by a Cocoa Beach police officer.
Oh, why don't you put me in Officer Brown, tell him to put me in handcuffs. What the is wrong with them?
What?
I'm concerned about a child that's being put into a machine, into one of these vehicles, and it's none of my business. You say something to them.
Well, they can't disclose information.
No, you tell. Okay. Cocoa Beach has gone mad.
Okay, hold
and
on.
Nasty.
They don't work for us. That's Brevard County Fire Rescue.
Well, you know I'm a teacher. Who got put in that car?
Well, it's a kid, but they can't disclose.
No, I was here hanging out at this party. I mean, what the what's wrong with them?
Okay.
You guys gotta act better.
Do you want the truth? There was like 200 kids here drinking.
I've already known.
Drinking, okay? And you're drunk as well.
I'm not drunk.
Yes, you are. I smell it.
Oh, you smell it. You
yes.
Might... All right, let's do a test.
No, we're not getting through that, but...
Do a test.
The purpose...
Well, but I'm saying, but okay. I'm concerned.
And you're intoxicated, too.
Oh, who cares? So I could get in your car and ride with you or call
my Because he's 17 and he was here drinking at a party.
Why are you yelling at me?
Because you're yelling. You're here with your boss having a party with 200 kids who are drinking. Get out of my face. Now.
That's on your camera.
It is.
The arrest affidavit paints quite a picture. Coolers of booze, weed smoke wafting in the breeze, a student with a gun, and an assault on a special needs student. Tonight, that lovely lady, Carly Anderson, the teacher, faces misdemeanor charges of disorderly conduct and disorderly intoxication. She was initially put on leave and then quietly transferred to another school as of this past Monday. But that was also the day that this body cam footage dropped, so now she's on leave again. the ex-principal, Ms. Hill-Brodigan. She faces felony charges of child neglect and contributing to the delinquency of a minor, and she is on leave, too, unpaid. We reached out to her lawyers, and they say they have no comment at this time. Still to come. What is it about April and epic historic crimes? Columbine, Virginia Tech, Oklahoma City, Waco. All of them happened not just in April, but this week in April. Is it a coincidence, or could there be a bizarre connection? Our True Crime Rewind is next. April 19th, 1995, 9:02 a.m. I'm sitting in my newsroom in Calgary, Canada, and we are all floored by the video that splashed across our screens. A 4,800-pound truck bomb has exploded right in front of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City. It looked like a war zone right in the heartland of the United States of America. And it happened exactly 30 years ago this week. The devastation was almost instantaneous. A third of the building was reduced to rubble in seconds. 300 neighboring buildings were flattened or heavily damaged. 168 people killed, including 19 little kids. And more than 800 other people were hurt. Here's some of what our KFOR, News Nation affiliate reporters, saw that day.
Well, Leah, just take a look for yourself. There's the Alfred Murray Federal Building behind me, and you can see just how badly damaged it is. It's about half of the building that is literally hanging, and at the bottom two floors are just stacked debris. Now, there are several other buildings right around to give you an idea of what kind of impact this had. Look at the Regency Towers there. Almost all the windows have been blown out of that hotel complex there. A several block area, it's complete devastation. Windows blown out of all the buildings. Some of these older brick buildings, the brick walls have collapsed. And they are still taking away dozens of casualties of this explosion.
Understandably, the first assumption was that a foreign terrorist had set off that bomb. But sadly, when the truth was later revealed, the soul of America was shattered. It was one of our own. A man who had even served our country, worn the uniform of the U.S. military, and he'd had help. Timothy McVeigh, along with Terry Nichols, were anti-government, and in their twisted view of our country, they wanted to start a war against leaders they considered to be tyrants. Both men were charged with multiple counts of first-degree murder and using a weapon of mass destruction. An accomplice named Michael Fortier was indicted on four counts, including conspiracy to transport stolen firearms. Reporter Mike Boettcher led the coverage for NBC News, and he was one of only three journalists who spoke with Timothy McVeigh. I talked about that with Mike and about covering the story of a lifetime. Mike, it is hard to believe it's been 30 years. Does it feel like 30 years since the Oklahoma City bombing?
Some days it does. Some days, like today, it feels like it was just yesterday. It's something I think about really every day, because I live 10 blocks from the Oklahoma City National Memorial where that bombing took place. And in the basement of my home are cracks in the foundation from the bombing that occurred that day, because it was like a small earthquake.
You're one of the first and only people, actually, so few people got a chance to speak with Timothy McVeigh, one of the bombers, the key bomber in this attack. Tell me about that. Tell me everything about your encounter with him.
Well, I knew his, you know, I'm an Okie, grew up here, and I knew his attorney, Stephen Jones, who was from a town about 40 miles from where I grew up. And I was in charge of the investigation for NBC News into the Oklahoma City bombing. And I wanted to interview McVeigh. His attorney, Stephen Jones, set up an interview at the El Reno Federal Reformatory west of Oklahoma City, where he was being held awaiting trial in Denver. I remember walking in and sitting down in a kind of sanitized room, and he came in an orange jumpsuit, They had to unshackle him. And I had made a connection with him initially because he was a veteran of Desert Storm. I was an embedded reporter in 1991 in Desert Storm when the U.S. took back Kuwait from Saddam Hussein's Iraqi forces. And so we talked about the war and all of that. He was, I remember he was a lot taller than I thought he would be. He was very, very polite. You know, he seemed like, you know, the boy next door that that you'd meet in your neighborhood. But once I turned the conversation towards the federal government and his thoughts on that, his eyes turned steely cold. And he said, I don't want to talk about that. I don't like the U.S. government. I think he used the word tyranny. I wasn't allowed, although I did ask. He wouldn't answer questions about the bombing. But you could see in his eyes the hatred for the U.S. government. And I'll never forget that because this nice young man, very polite, suddenly turned stone cold. And I was witnessing, you know, two different personalities in one sitting with Timothy McVeigh.
I have always wondered about this because when I heard back then, 30 years ago, as a young journalist, that he had made the comment that the children who were killed were, quote, collateral damage, I just wondered what it would have been like to be in the room. Did he seem at all divorced from the reality of 168 murders on his hands? Was it just did it just seem like a clinical function of his business?
I think the latter. I think you hit it on the head there, Ashley. I mean, he thought what he was doing was right. This was bombing was a response to Waco, to the Branch Davidian compound issue that occurred 2 years before on April 19th, 1993. He wanted to start a revolution against the government of the United States. He thought that's what would happen if he did this bombing. That is my belief. And to him, it was a military operation. They planned it out. He had toured the federal building. And I am convinced he knew that there was a daycare center in there. 19 children died that day. And even though there have been denials that he knew anything about that, to him, the victims were collateral damage to what he saw as his final objective, which was the overthrow of the government of the United States of America.
Love that conversation with Mike Boettcher. Timothy McVeigh was found guilty on all counts and was executed in 2001. Terry Nichols, on the far right there, he was found guilty of conspiracy and manslaughter and sentenced to life in prison with no parole. And Michael Fortier, the guy with the long hair, he was sentenced to 12 years in prison and released in 2006 and is now in the witness relocation program. How about that? News Nation has a special look back at the Oklahoma City bombing this weekend. On air live, Oklahoma City bombing 30 years later. It airs Saturday, 9 p.m. Eastern. Make sure you check it out. Do you remember the fire festival? It was more like a dumpster fire festival. Such a debacle. That swindle spawned two docuseries and landed its creator in prison. Still, I had a feeling that we hadn't heard the last of that guy, and I was right. After the break, Fire Festival 2. Got your tickets? Because I've got news for you. Next. Get out, fool me again, shame on me and shame on you. And I'm looking at you, Billy McFarland. It seems the promised sequel to Billy's disastrous Fire Festival is over before it began. I know you remember the original in 2017. The so-called luxury accommodations at Firefest were just tents with dirt floors. And the gourmet food promised, those were cold cheese sandwiches. Billy McFarland wound up convicted of wire fraud and was sentenced to 6 years in prison for swindling all those festival goers. But now he's out, and until this week was hyping Firefest 2, due to begin May 30th in Mexico. Get this, tickets were going from $1,400 all the way to $1.1 million. All for 4 days of, quote, music, arts, cuisine, comedy, fashion, gaming, sports, and treasure hunting. And this was supposed to happen on an island off Cancun. But in the least shocking news ever, the festival website announced yesterday that Firefest has been postponed. And in true Fire fashion, they couldn't even get that part right. A few hours later, the message said, no, no, we're just looking for a new location. And maybe that's because the officials in Mexico said they'd never heard of Fire Festival 2. Wherever the big event lands, if it lands, let's just hope that the place has food and working toilets to process whatever crap they are selling now. All right, quick note about Drop Dead Serious, my podcast. I got a couple things on there. If you're a true crime fan, you should check out. First and foremost, I got a daily update on the Lori Vallow trial in Phoenix. Did you know that her case is going on in the courtroom right across from Jodi Arias' case? Just, you know, fun fact. But I do have those daily updates on what's happened. And also a big, big send-up on Karen Reed's trial. It's getting underway on Friday. And if you've forgotten some things or if you think there's some things that are extra, there are. So I have laid out in this podcast, Drop Dead Serious, all the things that the prosecution has on her and all the things that she's bringing in as ammo. So it's a really good sort of scene setter for you to know what's coming in this trial. And those folks, free Karen.